Good morning. You've arrived at Listen Local, the bi-weekly webcast from your neighborhood news source, Mission Local, brought to you as always via BFM.FM. I'm Laura Wenis. This week we're bringing you two local stories from seasoned reporter Jenny Manrique Cortez. Jenny has done extensive reporting on violent conflict in her native Colombia, but has now been based in the United States for several years and has done extensive coverage on the situation of Latin American immigrants in the United States. The first piece we'll be hearing from Jenny is an audio adaptation of a piece she produced for the New American Media. That organization helps to connect and elevate ethnic media around the United States. For this story, Jenny delved into how the healthcare system can put immigrants through a gauntlet of unnecessary procedures and end up not really helping them at all, in effect, denying them the right to be sick.
Cristina Marquez has been living in San Francisco for 14 years. I arrived in 2001. My life was difficult. It changed a lot because I didn't know this country.
No conocía este país.
Cristina is 43 years old. Alongside her husband, Tirso Castro, they raised their four kids in the Mission District, Alejandro, Emmanuel, Jesus, and Juan Pablo. Indeed, the Castros have lived in the very same apartments in 2001. It is a three-story all-gray building in the middle of two Victorian row houses. This architecture doesn't have anything to do with the trees and crops of their hometown in Puebla, Mexico. Cristina remembers the struggle of her own mother to raise 14 kids, two of whom died. I remember that my siblings got sick, maybe when they were 15 or 16 years old. I don't know what sickness they had, but my mother used to put them out in the sun because they couldn't move. As many immigrants do, Cristina dreamed that somewhere in the United States she would have better opportunities and better health. We crossed the border walking. There were a lot of risks. I was scared because I always have been a fearful woman, and there were a lot of dangers. It was difficult, but we as parents take these risks for our future, for our kids' future. We were risking our lives. Many people died on the road.
No llegan acá, se quedan a medio camino.
Once in California, Cristina and her family struggled to gain basic rights. The right to education, the right to work, the right to have documentation, the right to have a proper identity. However, you won't see Cristina attending the rallies that many other Mexicans have organized along California to fight for a more fair immigration reform. It is not her style. Cristina is shy. She is small, she has short hair and bangs. She wears glasses. She speaks in a low voice and slowly. She is more devoted to her family and her house than to social activism. But she is deeply interested in defending one specific right. The right to be sick. From 2008 to 2010, Cristina's life was a nightmare.
Tuve hemorragia.
I had a nosebleed. It was out of the blue. I didn't know why. My children were really young. They were at school. It was around 8 p.m. I leaned back a bit, and when I tried to get up, I started to bleed and bleed, day and night. I couldn't rest.
Y así era día y noche, no podía descansar.
Cristina thought she was going to die and leave her kids as orphans. She visited the emergency room at the San Francisco General Hospital several times during 24 months. As an undocumented immigrant, she doesn't have health insurance. Cristina spent painful moments in the hospital trolleys waiting for attention. She says that she felt buckets of blood. Sometimes the nurses gave her gauze and at best clamps to stop the bleeding. My forehead was inflamed. I felt so much pain. The clamps didn't even stop the bleeding. I ate my own blood. It was gross.
Eso a mí no me gustaba porque sentía, me daba asco.
One day, in just 5 minutes, her pain was gone. A doctor had enough compassion for her and carefully open her nose to cauterize the vein.
It's going to be painful, Christina. Be calm.
She thought, more painful than what I've been through? No way. She feels better now, but the consequences of her bleeding are noticeable. Her teeth are starting to fall apart. Without health insurance, she can't afford to go to a dentist. She can't get braces. When I met her the first time, she was dying to eat some complimentary fruit that was in the table near us. But she can't chew hard food. As she gets older, the pain is getting worse, so she has to deal with that. There is a long path for immigrants to be guaranteed the right to be sick, as Christina calls it. Nowadays, undocumented immigrants are assisted in emergency rooms through the Medi-Cal, the insurance program for low-income residents. They can use it just in emergency cases. However, in July, healthcare advocates in California celebrated a landmark victory after Governor Jerry Brown revealed the budget for 2015.
Nearly $32 billion goes towards healthcare programs such as Medi-Cal. The budget includes money to provide healthcare coverage for children of undocumented immigrants, the very first plan of its kind in the nation.
The plan will be launched in April of next year and will cover close to 170,000 undocumented children. Democratic Senator Ricardo Lara, whose parents immigrated from Mexico, was one of the first to celebrate Governor Brown's budget. Last December, Lara introduced a bill known as Health for All. These days, he's campaigning all over California, promoting the bill.
The goal is to be able to transition the kid within 30 days of the program being operational. And it will ensure that the kids with serious medical conditions receive specialty care they need when they enroll.
Senator Lara thinks that Governor Brown's budget for undocumented children's health is a modest investment that yields big returns. He reminds people that now they have to fight for the adults. Even with kids covered, 1.5 million undocumented immigrants will remain without health coverage. Lara's campaign is targeting precisely that community.
Me llamo Jesús Castro y tengo 20 años.
Jesús is one of Christina's sons. He is 20 years old. Jesús, in contrast to his mother, is an activist. He attends different immigration forums and is always searching for information about his legal rights. In fact, he has a goal.
Mi meta es ser un abogado de inmigración.
My goal is to be an immigration lawyer. I want to help immigrants like me. I understand their stories. I think that all immigrants have a very powerful story and all of them need help.
Necesitan ayuda.
Since Jesús grew up in California, he is bilingual. He feels comfortable speaking both in English and Spanish, but when he's with his mother or he shares anecdotes of his childhood in Mexico, he picks his native language.
In Mexico, while I was playing with my bike, the wheel pulled off my fingernails. My mother didn't notice until she saw my fingers. I've never been a complaining type of person. Obviously, I hurt myself sometimes, but I hid it, so my mother wouldn't get mad. It actually didn't hurt me that much, but I was scared that if my mother found out, she would scold me.
Se diera cuenta y que me regañara.
Jesús convinced his mother, Cristina, to share her story. He strongly believes that speaking out could create a domino effect.
It could be like a domino effect, then it's like a ripple effect.
Jesús has witnessed Cristina's health problems, such as the nose bleeding, and more recently, backaches due to slept discs. Furthermore, Cristina's vision is worsening due to her age.
Ella lee mucho, la Biblia.
My mother likes to read the Bible a lot. Sometimes she studies English because she still wants to learn. But it's hard for her to read such small letters.
Las letras tan pequeñas que vienen.
I was tired of seeing my mom using my youngest brother's glasses, which she found in a cabin. One day I told her, that's enough. I'm going to buy you a pair of glasses for your birthday, no matter how expensive they are.
Jesús knows pretty well what an emergency room in San Francisco is. And this is not just because of his mother's illness. When Jesús was 6 years old, he dislocated his elbow while playing baseball. He was a newly arrived to the city. Jesús ended up in the emergency room of the General Hospital. He was put on a bed. He received a Tylenol and for the next 2 hours, nothing else. His parents, Cristina and Tirso, were asked several times if they were insured. They answered several times, no. A nurse gave him a brace to keep up the arm, but that was all. If they wanted to see a professional doctor, they actually had to pay $1,500, Cristina said. Desperate, his father, Tirso, found a bone healer.
Y encontraron a un curandero.
They drove a couple of hours outside San Francisco to find Jesus a remedy.
Y llegamos con un viejito, una casa humilde y...
We arrived to a humble house where an old humble man lived. He started to rub my elbow while telling me a story about when he was younger. He was trying to distract me. Then he put my elbow back in place.
Yo el dolor cuando me regresara mi codo a su lugar.
Jesús' trip to the curandero was a must. But he reminds us that in his native Puebla, Mexico, he never complained about anything, although alongside his brothers, he knew how to get in trouble.
Saltábamos a veces de edificios.
We used to jump from the top of buildings to the ground. We were very spoiled. We thought that we were so strong. When we arrived here to the United States, things changed so much. We couldn't play as much here as in Mexico because people get mad.
Cristina and Jesús didn't come to the United States together.
Llegamos en carro. Nosotros, mi padre,
we arrived in a car. My father paid a lot of money, so we didn't have to cross the hill as my mother did in the desert. An American woman said that we were her kids, so we could cross.
Solo para que pudiéramos pasar.
14 years later, Jesús Castro will finally have health insurance. He got a job less than a month ago as a beneficiary of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA. He's entitled to work. DACA allows certain undocumented immigrants who enter the United States under the age of 16 and before June of 2007 to get a renewable two-year work permit. They are also exempt of being deported. The youngest of Jesús' brothers is the only one not covered by DACA yet. He is in the application process. Jesús envisions that soon all of the Castros could be working and getting some type of health coverage. But what about Cristina and Tirso? Are his parents going to have to wait endlessly in emergency rooms? He wonders.
We take about a third of the ambulances in the city.
This is Rachel Keegan. She is the spokeswoman for the San Francisco Department of Public Health. She is talking about the San Francisco General Hospital, the place that Cristina Castro visited permanently for 2 years in pain.
We operate the busiest emergency room in the city, and we also operate the only trauma center in the city.
Rachel explains that what influences the decision about patients' care doesn't have anything to do with their immigration status.
What does influence decisions about care in the emergency room is the severity of the person's illness or injury. And because we are the trauma center, the very first people generally who are cared for are the folks who come in an ambulance with a traumatic injury.
Cristina avoids calling ambulances. When the pain was intolerable, she used to walk the 18 blocks that separate her house from the hospital. Still, Cristina walked for 30 minutes in pain, keeping her head tilted back, covering her nose with layers of cotton and handkerchiefs. One day, she couldn't wait any longer and called 911. They charged me $1,500 for the ambulance. I wasn't working, so the truth is that I never pay for that. Sometimes I still receive the bill. Rachel Keegan from the San Francisco Department of Public Health says that an emergency room is not a place to access a primary care doctor. She says the city can assist undocumented immigrants under the program Healthy San Francisco.
This is a universal health care access program that is open to undocumented immigrants as well as people who are documented or who are citizens. It is, again, immigration status is not a screener in the Healthy San Francisco program.
This is how it works. The immigrant shouldn't be enrolled in any type of health insurance. Not Medi-Cal, which is for low-income residents. Not Covered California, which is the Obamacare for the state of California. If that is the case, that person can apply to Healthy San Francisco. He or she will have a primary care doctor and a clinic, but first needs to fulfill some requirements.
Make less than the federal poverty level or up to 5 times.
Which means that monthly, a family of five, as the Castros, shouldn't make more than $1,900 to be covered.
You also must be a San Francisco resident. You must be uninsured for at least 90 days. You must be an adult, 18 years or older.
This is a unique program for the city, so it doesn't cover a situation in which a person is hurt outside San Francisco. Additionally, it is just an access program, not health insurance, so even if an immigrant meets the requirements, the network of doctors and pharmacists is very limited. With access to some medical services in the mission, Jesus is now experiencing what is to have a primary care doctor in the United States. He is slowly getting used to the world of insured people, filling out forms, dealing with copayments, and occasionally hearing, your health insurance doesn't cover that. Still, he now has the right to be sick.
In this next piece, we'll have a look at the mission as it once was. The Freedom Archive is a mission-based treasure trove of glimpses into local activist history. Jenny visited the Freedom Archives to dig up a few of these gems and to listen to the voices of some of the most influential activists and politicians of bygone eras. She also got a little bit of perspective on what it's like to guard this treasure with interviews from the curators and caretakers of the archive.
In 1965, the workers in the fields said, basta. We're fed up with all of the exploitation. We're fed up with being the worst paid workers in America. We're fed up with being exploited. We want a new life. We want a union. We want to do something for ourselves and our families. And they went on strike.
This is Cesar Chavez.
And everybody, all the experts throughout the country said that they were crazy because they couldn't win because the growers were very powerful and that the workers were very weak.
If you live in the Mission District, you probably know that Cesar Chavez is a street surrounded by houses, schools, a church, and a smattering of businesses.
People say, well, what is it to me about farm workers? What do I have to do with farm workers? Why should I care?
And let me tell you why. Cesar Chavez is a street that divides the Mission District and Bernal Heights. Once known as Army Street, the name change became the subject of a political battle because of what Cesar Chavez represents.
The vegetables and the nuts and the grains that come to your table got there because someone was exploited. Because men.
He is the best known Hispanic American civil rights activist who, together with Dolores Huertas, founded the National Farm Workers Association.
What's happening?
This is Dolores.
The armies are growing stronger. The armies overseas and the armies in the United States. And the police are getting stronger. And the number of our brothers that are getting killed in the cities is growing. Our black brothers, our brown brothers, our student brothers, and our poor white brothers are still getting gunned down.
Their powerful voices and others that belong to social justice movements from the 60s to the 90s are well preserved in a modest office in Valencia Street, the Freedom Archives.
There were a number of us who founded the Freedom Archives, who did independent journalism back in the late 60s and early 70s.
Claude Marx is a 66-year-old man who was born in Argentina. He is the director of the Freedom Archives.
When I came back to San Francisco, we wanted to figure out a way to organize the materials and repurpose the programs that we had done because of their political and cultural significance.
Over 14,000 records, audio and video clips, testimonies collected from vinyl, tape and film that have been restored, digitized and archived. That is what you can find here in the Mission, an entire library of oral history. One which has a strong meaning and connection with our current history and with our present.
We're trying to chronicle a consistent level of resistance to government policies, to racism, to oppression. Without question, the political framework that is reflected by our materials is antagonistic to the people who run this country.
I think a lot of the challenges that marginalized communities have in the Bay Area, but in the United States in total, is this connection with the legacy of resistance.
Nathaniel Moore is the archivist at the Freedom Archives.
Young people grow up and they know that something came before them, but they don't necessarily exactly know what it is or can't necessarily engage it, and they don't learn about it in schools. So they might hear certain things, or they've heard certain stories from their elders, but they don't exactly really know. And so I think that by hearing things that talk about this resistance and illuminate these voices, that is formative to how people decide to shape their reality today.
Yo tengo la conciencia tranquila de no haberme salido.
In good conscience, I can say that I'm very comfortable with my role as what you call the shepherd of my flock. As the representative of the church and following the directives of Medellin and Puebla, the church cannot separate itself from the politics and daily life of the people. I'm not at the service of any ideology. I support a concrete project, and I am at the service of the popular organization.
Monsignor Romero is one of those voices. The Archbishop of San Salvador spoke out against poverty, social injustice, and torture, and was assassinated in 1980. Salvadorans in the mission celebrate his legacy every year, and he is portrayed in several murals in the neighborhood. His speeches are part of the Latin America collection, one of the 13 umbrella collections that are in the archives.
So we've got a sub-collection specifically about Cuba. And that collection not only has resources and materials that were about the Cuban Revolution, but also materials that, you know, from Cuba and from people going to Cuba since then. So in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and different reports. That collection may have things about Nicaragua, not just materials about the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, but also Nicaraguan support, for an example, like in the mission. Poetry events that took place in the late 70s in the mission that were in solidarity with the Sandinistas.
We produced a documentary originally in 2003 about the coup in Chile. We produced this program with the idea of talking about the other 9/11. September 11th, 1973 was the date that the coup led by Pinochet and supported entirely by the U.S. took place to overthrow a progressively elected government and resulted in massive numbers of people being executed, imprisoned, tortured. The Bay Area was a center for Chileno activity. La Peña was formed as part of that. A lot of artists through the Mission Cultural Center, they ranged from artists to people who are well known, like Isabel Allende, who lives in the Bay Area, who was one of the people who reminisced about her own experience in Chile at the time.
It is, to me, always surprising how little we know here in the States of what the foreign policy of this country has been and is all about. When we speak about 9/11 in the United States, is of course the terrorist attack in New York. For me, 9/11 is 9/11-1973, the military coup in Chile.
There is another collection that speaks a lot to the mission and is devoted to the Chicano Latina culture. You can find there some raw materials aired on La Raza radio program by producers like Chuy Varela, currently at KCSN Radio. There is also a series called Californians of Mexican Descent, produced by Colin Edwards, who worked for the BBC, the Canadian Broadcasting, and the Irish Radio. When Edwards died, the Freedom Archives approached his family to assure them that his material, which covers topics like the anti-war movement and the Black Panther Party, would not be censored. This type of material inspired new work.
We're currently actually working on a film that talks about the Chicano struggle. It talks about living in occupied Mexico, which California was a part of. It talks about the vibrancy of the student movement of the 70s, which was attacked with the same level of violence as the Black Liberation Movement was at the time. So we talk about the student movement, we talk about land struggles, we talk about the exploitation of workers who are called immigrants, but who rightfully were a part of this land well before the gold rush happened. rather than just talking about illegal immigrants, which is an imperial term, a colonial term. We really want to reframe what that history is.
Books, documentaries, audio recordings, and educational materials that are used in high school classes. This is the work that Claude and Nathaniel have done with a group of volunteers and interns from colleges around the country. They rely on small grants and annual donations from the community to spread this oral history.
A huge part of our collection includes voices from within prisons. People who are locked away with intentionality. And in most cases, this is justified by the government on a political basis or on a social political basis, given what mass imprisonment looks like today of 2.4 million people.
Few of us may know the name Hugo Pinnell. That's because the last time he was in the newspapers was probably in 1971 or 1976, when he was tried as a member of the famous San Quentin Six. Six young black prisoners facing assault charges stemming from battles with guards at the notoriously repressive California prison. And he has spent the last 42 years in prison, 34 of them in solitary. He hasn't had a write-up in 24 years, after a lifetime in some of the most repressive joints in America. Why so long?
These days, the archives continue producing materials that belong to those unheard voices, like the ones in prisons, but they feel they have other challenges.
Anyone who's into preserving unpopular voices or unpopular perspectives, there's going to be a struggle to get your stuff out there in the volume that is the dominant narrative. And so that's something that we always are conscious of, and we always, you know, are working within that challenge. By really diversifying the groups of people that do use our material, how we put things out, from, you know, blogs to documentaries to books to, you know, actual physical being out in the community and talking with people.
We're here for the community, and we hope that more and more people hear about us and utilize us to strengthen their resolve to maintain what is, in fact, the Mission District of San Francisco, what is a level of Bay Area reality that has always challenged the dominant and most oppressive aspect of what the United States tries to be.
As Edmund Burke said, those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. You can find more at freedomarchives.org. Thanks for listening.
That brings us to the end of today's show. You've been tuned in to Listen Local, brought to you by the staff of Mission Local. If you know something we don't that you think we should, shoot us an email at info@missionlocal.com. If email isn't your bag, tweet at us. We are at ML Now. Also keep an eye out for our semi-annual print edition, which came out December 1st and should have arrived at a coffee shop, laundromat, or merchant near you. After this, stick around for some electronic tunes and more from across the pond, brought to you by John Digital. Thanks for listening.